listening to the English language news of Khan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
It's 8 p.m. in Israel, Monday, March the 25th, 2024, in the headlines. Israel-U.S. tensions climb further as Prime Minister Netanyahu cancels senior aide's trip to Washington after the U.S. abstains in a U.N. Security Council vote on a Gaza ceasefire demand. The Shin Bet says it foiled Iranian plans to smuggle advanced weapons to terrorists in Judea and Samaria. IDF forces conclude an operation in the Hamad section of Khan Yunis. Rockets are fired at Ashdod from Gaza for the first time in 2 months. National Right Party leader, Cabinet Minister Gideon Saar, is set to issue a statement this evening. He is widely expected to announce he is pulling out of the government over the refusal of his request to be included in the war cabinet. Coalition tensions are high over the yeshiva draft law. The weather outlook, windy with seasonal temperatures becoming much warmer over coming days. Good evening. This is Nomi Segal with the news. Israel-U.S. tensions are climbing, this after the U.N. Security Council this afternoon passed a non-binding resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip hostilities, not contingent on release of hostages, after the United States abstained in the vote. The remaining 14 council members voted for the resolution, which was proposed by the 10 elected members of the body, in response to the U.S. failure to veto the resolution, wording Israel opposed. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu canceled a planned trip of senior aides to Washington this week. The United States had been averse to the word ceasefire earlier in the nearly six-month-old war in the Gaza Strip and had used its veto power to shield Israel as it retaliated against Hamas for the October 7th attacks. But amid growing global pressure for a truce in the war, the U.S. abstained from the vote today to allow the Security Council to demand an immediate ceasefire for the Muslim month of Ramadan. The resolution also calls for the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages and emphasizes the urgent need to expand the flow of humanitarian assistance to the Gaza Strip. In remarks after the vote, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said Hamas has been putting up obstacles to a hostage release deal.
We're getting closer to a deal for an immediate ceasefire with the release of all hostages, but we're not there yet. Now, let's be clear. A ceasefire could have come about months ago if Hamas had been willing to release hostages. Months ago. Instead, Hamas continues to stand in the way of peace, to throw up roadblocks, cower in tunnels beneath Gaza cities and behind under civilian infrastructure and hide among the civilian population. So today, my ask to members of this council and to member states in every region of the world is this: speak out and demand unequivocally that Hamas accepts the deal on the table. Colleagues, we appreciated the willingness of members of this council to take some of our edits and improve on this resolution. Still, certain key edits were ignored, including our request to add a condemnation of Hamas. And we did not agree with everything in the resolution. For that reason, we were unfortunately not able to vote yes. However, as I've said before, we fully support some of the critical objectives in this non-binding resolution, and we believe it was important for the council to speak out and make clear that any ceasefire must come with the release of all hostages. Indeed, as I've said before, the only path to a durable end to this conflict is the release of all hostages. Critically, a ceasefire and the release of hostages will allow much more humanitarian aid to get into Gaza at a time when famine is looming large, and provide an opportunity to work toward a sustainable cessation of hostilities. This resolution rightly acknowledges that during the month of Ramadan, we must recommit to peace. Hamas can do that by accepting the deal on the table. A ceasefire can begin immediately with the release of the first hostage. And so we must put pressure on Hamas to do just that. This is the only path to securing a ceasefire and the release of hostages, as we have all called for today. That is what this resolution means. A ceasefire of any duration must come with the release of hostages. This is the only path.
The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. Israel's ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan, accused the Security Council of a moral double standard.
Why can this council call on Boko Haram to lay down their arms, but the same cannot be demanded of the murderous Hamas terrorists? Is the life of little baby Kfir Bibas worth less than the life of Nigerian child? Sadly, it's for the same reason why you can condemn terror attacks in Russia and Iran, but not in Israel. To this council, Israeli blood is cheap. This is a travesty, and I'm disgusted.
Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, Gilad Erdan. Meanwhile, the Palestinian observer to the UN, Riyad Mansour, called the vote an historic decision. As we heard, Prime Minister Netanyahu had threatened shortly before the vote, and when it was apparently apparent that the U.S. would abstain, that he would cancel the planned trip by his aides to Washington if the U.S. does not veto the resolution. He carried through on it after the vote. The Prime Minister's office said Netanyahu had canceled the planned trip to Washington by his top aides, Ron Dermer and Tsachi Hanegbi, after the U.S. refrained from using a veto to block a U.N. Security Council resolution backed by Russia and China that called for a ceasefire without conditioning it on the release of hostages. In a statement from the Prime Minister's office, Israel said the United States is harming the war effort and attempts to free hostages by the decision. The statement called the decision a clear retreat from the consistent U.S. position in the Security Council since the beginning of the war, and one that gives Hamas hope that international pressure will allow them to get a ceasefire without releasing our hostages. The trip by the Israeli delegation to meet with U.S. administration officials was agreed upon in Prime Minister Netanyahu's conversation last week with U.S. President Joe Biden, and it was intended to address, according to statements at the time, alternatives to a broad Israeli military offensive in Rafah and other issues related to the Gaza hostilities. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said the U.S. was disappointed by Prime Minister Netanyahu's decision not to send an Israeli delegation to Washington to discuss alternatives to a major invasion of Rafah. He made the remarks in a briefing earlier.
We were looking forward to having an opportunity to speak to an Israeli delegation later this week about exploring viable options and alternatives to a major ground offensive in Rafah. I'll let the Israelis speak to whether they're coming or not. And I saw what Prime Minister Netanyahu said he would do. And I've seen some early press reporting in just the last couple of minutes that they have moved forward with that. I can't confirm it. They can speak to that. That's really for them. All I can tell you is we were looking forward to having a discussion with them about alternatives and options to a major ground offensive, because we don't believe that a ground offensive in Rafah is the right course of action.
White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby. The U.S. State Department said it was surprising and unfortunate that the Israeli delegation decided not to come to scheduled talks this week after the U.S. abstained from the U.N. vote demanding an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller added that a full-scale invasion of Rafah, the last refuge for about half of Gaza's 2.3 million population following the arrival of many people displaced by fighting elsewhere, would be a mistake and would weaken Israel's security. A U.S. official told reporters that the United States was perplexed by Israel's abrupt decision to withdraw from the scheduled talks this week about Gaza and considers it an overreaction to the U.S. abstention from a U.N. vote. The official told a group of reporters that domestic political tensions in Israel probably were responsible for Prime Minister Netanyahu's decision not to send the Israeli delegation to Washington for the talks. The official added that President Joe Biden has no plans to call Netanyahu about the decision, nor did Netanyahu call Biden about it in advance. And turning to those coalition dynamics, National Unity Party leader, Cabinet Minister Benny Gantz, said in response to the UN Security Council vote that it has no operative meaning for Israel, and in any case, Israel will continue to listen to its friends and always do what is right for Israel's security. He wrote in a post that the special relations between Israel and the United States are an anchor for Israel's security and foreign relations, and direct talks with the administration is an essential asset that should not be given up when there are challenges and disagreement. Gantz went on to say that not only should the delegation set out for the U.S., but it would have been good if the prime minister would travel to the U.S. himself and hold a direct dialogue with President Biden and senior officials. Netanyahu responded in a statement regarding Gantz's suggesting that the visit take place, especially after Hamas praised the vote and called for a ceasefire without conditioning it on the release of hostages. In other Israeli political reaction, opposition leader Yair Lapid of Yesh Atid assailed the prime minister for canceling the trip of the delegation to Washington. Lapid said Netanyahu's defiant announcement to the Americans is another miserable and sad attempt to divert attention from the yeshiva draft bill at the expense of Israel's relations with the United States. It displays panic and irresponsibility from a prime minister who has lost it, he wrote on the social media platform X. Meanwhile, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, who is currently visiting the United States for an official trip, says Israel has no moral right to stop the war in Gaza until we return all the hostages to their homes. The remarks were released by his office ahead of Gallant's meetings with the U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and the Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, and shortly after the U.N. Security Council passed the resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, after the U.S. withheld its veto and abstained from the vote. In the first meeting with National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, I will make clear the importance of collapsing the Hamas regime and returning the hostages to their homes. We will act against Hamas everywhere, even in areas where we have not yet been. We will create an alternative to Hamas so that the IDF can complete its mission, Gallant said. If we don't reach a clear and absolute victory in Gaza, it could bring a war in the north closer, he said. On day 171 of the Israel-Hamas war, rocket fire on both the southern and northern fronts. After a lull of nearly 2 months, 8 rockets were fired from the Gaza Strip toward Ashdod this afternoon. There were no injuries and no reports of damage. The Iron Dome intercepted 2 of the rockets. 6 others fell in open areas. An IDF check indicated that launches toward Ashdod originated in the central Gaza Strip. This evening, 2 rockets were fired from Gaza were intercepted, one over Sderot and the other over Netivot. Earlier this morning, there were initial concerns of an infiltration attempt of Israeli territory after Palestinians came within 100 meters of the security fence by Nahal Oz. But the IDF stressed there was no infiltration and a return to routine was announced. At this hour, National Right Party leader Gideon Saar is holding a press conference, and he has just announced that he is pulling out of the emergency government. He has said that he sees painfully how the management of this current war is not bringing us to achieve our objectives. There is no organized plan to destroy the Hamas leadership, Saar said. We'll have more on his statement, which was anticipated, this against the backdrop of the recent rejection of his demand to be included in the war cabinet. In the north, several rockets were fired from Lebanon toward the area of Rosh HaNikra. There were no injuries or damage. Warnings of a suspected hostile air infiltration were determined to be false. In the Gaza Strip, the IDF has concluded its operations in the Hamad neighborhood of Khan Yunis after more than 20 days of fighting. Some 300 terrorists were arrested and dozens of others were eliminated. Large amounts of weapons were seized and terror infrastructure was destroyed. This week, the IDF forces began operating in the Al-Amal neighborhood in a different part of Khan Yunis. Dozens of terrorists have been killed. Israeli troops also continued targeted fighting against terrorists barricading themselves in the area of Shifa Hospital. The IDF spokesperson, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, says that Hamas and Islamic Jihad have hijacked the Shifa Hospital and were using it as a headquarters, hiding behind the sick and wounded. In remarks in English, the IDF spokesperson said the raid on the hospital launched a week ago was one of the most successful operations in the nearly six-month war, killing over 170 terrorists and apprehending over 500 terrorists, many of whom planned and carried out the October 7th massacres.
Today is day six of the IDF's operation against Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Shifa Hospital. 170 terrorists were neutralized in or around the Shifa Hospital compound while firing at our forces. The IDF apprehended hundreds of terror suspects with confirmed ties to Hamas or Islamic Jihad, making this one of the most successful operations since the start of the war. A large number of these terrorists were involved in planning and executing the brutal massacre of October 7th. This operation isn't over yet. Right now, Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists are barricading themselves inside the Shifa Hospital wards. Hamas is destroying the Shifa Hospital. Hamas is firing from inside the Shifa emergency room and maternity ward, and throwing explosives devices from the Shifa burn ward. Terrorists hiding around the hospital are firing mortars at our forces, causing extensive damage to the hospital buildings. I repeat, Hamas is firing mortars at the Shifa hospital. Hamas is destroying the Shifa hospital. Hamas hijacked the Shifa hospital and hide behind the sick and the wounded, waging war from inside the Shifa hospital. The IDF operates with precision, acts with care, especially towards the patient and the medical staff inside the hospital. We do this because we distinguish between Hamas terrorists and the civilians they are hiding behind. We do this because our war is against Hamas, not against the people of Gaza. And our actions prove this. Since the beginning of this operation against Hamas at Shifa Hospital, the IDF has assisted the sick and the wounded and helped move many of them out of harm's way. We brought dozens of medical devices, over 10,000 units of medications, hundreds of medical supplies, as well as food, water, and other equipment into the Shifa Hospital. When Hamas's attacks resulted in the failure of the hospital's generator, our troops helped restore the electricity to the hospital. Our operation at Shifa Hospital proves once again, Hamas systematically uses hospitals to wage war and consistently uses the people of Gaza as human shields.
IDF spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari. The tensions in the north. Air Force fighter jets attacked a Hezbollah military compound in the Misal Jabal area overnight, where its fighters had gathered. Hezbollah reported at least one of its operatives killed. The strike came after Hezbollah fired about 15 rockets from Lebanon toward an IDF position near Manara. There were no reports of any casualties. Hezbollah claimed responsibility. It's been cleared for publication that Israeli security forces thwarted in recent months smuggling of advanced weapons from Iran to Judea and Samaria. A joint statement from the IDF and Shin Bet said that the delivery included rockets, shrapnel bombs, mines, revolvers, rifles, anti-tank rockets, and hand grenades. The statement said that the Special Operations Branch of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps was behind the smuggling attempt. And as we just heard, the National Right Party leader, New Hope National Right Party leader, Gideon Saar, announced a short while ago that he is pulling out of the government. The announcement was expected, and it comes on the heels of his split from his alliance with the National Unity Party. This over the rejection of his demand that he be included in the war cabinet. In the statement, Sa'ar said that there does not seem to be a clear plan in the war to achieve its goals, and he said that he cannot be held responsible when he does not have an ability to make an impact. This comes as coalition tensions have also been rising over the proposed law on military service exemptions for yeshiva students, which is expected to be presented to the government tomorrow for approval. A Khan reporter notes that the resignations of ministers come into effect only after 48 hours, meaning the ministers in Sa'ar's party will be able to vote tomorrow in the government meeting on the proposed law. Cabinet Minister Yifat Shasha Biton told Khan earlier that she and her colleagues in the National Right Party would vote against the measure. As we heard, the government is slated to convene tomorrow for a vote on the Prime Minister's proposed bill on military service exemptions for ultra-Orthodox. The revised draft of the contentious bill that was circulated to the cabinet ministers ahead of the vote. As Khan had reported, the revised version dropped a clause that raised to the age of 35 military service exemptions for Haridim. A clause was also added regarding economic sanctions to be imposed on ultra-Orthodox institutions that do not meet enlistment targets. At the same time, the proposal does not define these targets, which will be determined in the bill. The proposal has been assailed by the opposition and also criticized within the coalition. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had warned government ministers that not supporting the draft law could lead to the coalition collapse. A Khan reporter says some of the Likud ministers were waiting for the proposal to be brought to the Knesset in the hope that they would be able to come to terms with the final text. Benny Gantz, head of the National Unity Party and former IDF chief of staff, had threatened to quit the emergency government if the yeshiva draft bill in its original form is passed into law. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant of the Likud also said he would not support any proposed draft bill that was not agreed upon by consensus in all coalition parties. A Khan reporter says ministers from the United Torah Judaism Party were considering staying away from tomorrow's cabinet meeting or voting against the revised proposal. In the opposition, Yair Lapid of Yesh Atid called on the National Unity Party to quit the government now if the conscription outline is approved by the cabinet and not wait until it goes through the Knesset legislative process. In other comment, the Israel Business Forum says the draft exemption bill that would be discussed will exacerbate inequality in society and could disintegrate the social fabric precisely at the most difficult time for the state of Israel. It said the current version will set the Israeli economy back 20 years, and this must not be allowed. In other news, the UN aid chief, Martin Griffiths, is set to step down at the end of June for health reasons, the UN spokesperson announced today. Griffiths, a British diplomat who heads the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, has been in the role since 2021 and has recently advocated for more humanitarian access to Gaza. Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman Safadi, today accused Israel of withholding food and water and medication from Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. In a joint news conference with the visiting United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, Safadi called on the UN Security Council members to approve the resolution on a Gaza ceasefire that was put to a vote today, as it was. He also expressed support for the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA, and praised those donor countries that have renewed their funding for the organization. Here's an excerpt from his remarks.
Nothing justifies denying when men, women, and children their right to food and to medicine. Almost 1 million Palestinians now are at ICP level 5. That means over 1 million Palestinians are facing famine. Supplies have not been allowed into major parts of Gaza, including the north. So basically what we have is that Palestinians are killed by Israeli bullets, and we're having Palestinians dying from starvation, from dehydration. This has gone on for way too far. Israel has violated every humanitarian law, every moral principle, every humanitarian value, and unfortunately the world is still unable to say enough and say stop. Today the Security Council will be voting on a resolution demanding ceasefire, demanding the entry of supplies. We urge all members of the Security Council to support that resolution, if only to send a message that what's happening is unacceptable and what's happening has to stop. We thank you for your strong voice. We thank you for the positions that you've taken, demanding respect for international law, demanding respect for the UN Charter, and urging an immediate end to war crimes and to the killing and starving of the innocent. And we will continue to work with you, sir, to make sure that we end this madness. And we're going to continue to work with our international partners to make sure that the world stands united in saying enough is enough. The UN and Jordan have been solid partners for decades. Not only do we work together on the Palestinian issue, but we also work together on addressing the needs of refugees. Obviously, UNRWA is here, and I recognize the Commissioner General, who's him and his organization have been doing a tremendous job in trying to ease the suffering of the Palestinian people at those times that are, again, trying our whole humanity. So I just want to say that UNRWA is indispensable. It is irreplaceable. And we're happy to see that many countries are coming back now to helping UNRWA save lives, because every dollar that is given to UNRWA is saving a human life, and every dollar taken away from UNRWA carries the risk of having a child suffer and die from the lack of food and medicines.
Jordanian Foreign Minister Amin Safadi. The UN Secretary General Guterres, for his part, said there's growing international consensus to tell Israel a ceasefire is needed. And he said a broad military assault on Rafah would lead to a catastrophic humanitarian situation.
We must face facts. There will be no sustainable humanitarian solution with an ongoing war as bloody as this. Let me repeat. Nothing justifies the abhorrent October 7 attacks and hostage taking by Hamas, and nothing justifies the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. The effective delivery of humanitarian aid requires the immediate delivery of a humanitarian ceasefire. The need is urgent. I was at the Rafah border crossing this weekend, and I met with injured Palestinian civilians and directly from our frontline humanitarian colleagues. They are veterans of some of the worst humanitarian crises in recent decades. They have seen it all. And yet, without exception, they told me they had never seen anything as horrible as what is happening in Gaza today. The scale and speed of the deaths and destruction are on an entirely different level. And now starvation is bearing down on Palestinians in Gaza. There is a growing consciousness around the world that all of these must stop. The fighting must end now. The hostages must be released now. And we must not lose sight of the big picture. A lasting end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict can only come through a two-state solution. Israelis must see their legitimate needs for security materialized, and Palestinians must see their legitimate aspirations for a fully independent, viable, and sovereign state realized in line with United Nations resolutions, international law, and previous agreements. We know where the alternative would lead: to indefinitely prolonging a conflict that has become a major threat to global peace and security. In relation to the northern part of Gaza, it is absolutely essential to have a massive supply of humanitarian aid now. And this means opening more entry points. This means a concentration of efforts of all entities without obstacles, without limitations from the Israeli side, in order to be able to rescue the people of northern Gaza of an imminent risk of famine. Many children are already today dying of hunger. Finally, in relation to the SOS, to Rafah, our position has been very clear. We consider that a ground offensive against Rafah could lead to a catastrophic humanitarian situation.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Israel has rejected the claims that it has placed obstacles to the supply of humanitarian assistance to Gaza. In an online briefing, a government spokesperson, David Mentzer, also said that UNRWA is a front for Hamas and confirmed Israel is winding down its cooperation with the organization. He also reiterated that Israel will operate against Hamas in Rafah. He spoke first to the supply of assistance to the enclave.
103 humanitarian aid trucks went into Gaza yesterday after inspection. Only 28 were distributed by the UN aid agencies. 22 from the private sector food trucks went to northern Gaza Strip overnight. 24 aid trucks were transferred to Gaza via the Jordanian route. 88 packages, 1 ton each, of humanitarian aid were airdropped over northern Gaza yesterday. In addition, tankers of cooking gas and fuel have gone into Gaza. The usual 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. humanitarian pause took place today in Al-Shabura neighborhood in Rafah to allow the movement of humanitarian aid. These are the real figures. The UN quotes Hamas figures uncritically, the same Hamas that claims that Jews are descendants of pigs and monkeys. There is stable food supply in southern Gaza. Markets are bustling. Food stocks are piled high in the aid agency warehouses. In northern Gaza, our proactive measures are providing relief. Now, UNRWA went over 6 weeks without requesting a single aid convoy. Only over the past few days, they have made but three requests. You know, Hamas's objective is to create an image of humanitarian crisis. Where there is hunger in Gaza, it is hunger orchestrated by Hamas. These are the images they create. These are the images they want you to see. I can guarantee these three things. I've said them before. No one in Hamas is hungry. Number two, Hamas and other criminal and terrorist gangs steal the aid. And number three, Hamas wants to maximize the suffering of ordinary civilians. Why? To stop the war, to protect their own skins. Today and every day, by air, land and sea, aid is entering Gaza. And as for UNRWA, you know, many are working hard to keep Hamas in power and keep UNRWA relevant. Let me reiterate the Israeli position. UNRWA is a front for Hamas. UNRWA employees actively participated in the October 7th massacre. UNRWA employees took and held Israeli civilians hostage. The UNRWA HQ served as a literal cover for a Hamas server farm and intelligence base. UNRWA is not part of the solution. It is part of the problem. UNRWA is tainted with terrorism. Their primary goal is to perpetuate the Palestinian refugee problem. Their leaders disseminate libel, and therefore the organization needs to be dissolved. UNRWA are part of the problem, and we will now stop working with them. We are actively phasing out the use of UNRWA because they perpetuate the conflict rather than try and alleviate the conflict.
Vice President Kamala Harris told ABC News yesterday that she has, and I quote, studied the maps. And that it is not possible to evacuate civilians from Rafah before the Israeli operation there. Is she correct on the maps?
First things first, we of course want to thank our American friends for the steadfast support they have provided us since the October 7th massacre, not least in providing those two aircraft carriers off our coasts to prevent the situation from widening elsewhere in the region, for providing us with the armaments we need to defend ourselves, and of course their support in the United Nations. We've made clear our opinion on Rafah. Hamas remaining in Rafah is not an option. It would be the same as if the Allies allowed Hitler and the Nazis to remain in Berlin. A defeat of Hamas is absolutely crucial. They must be defeated comprehensively to be able to rebuild Gaza and to free Gaza from Hamas. The Prime Minister has made his and the war cabinet, and I think there is entire support amongst Israel's people. We will not allow Hamas to remain in Rafah. We will not allow it. And of course, a key part of our plan is to move innocent civilians out of harm's way. So I want to be clear about this. If Hamas are in Rafah, we will defeat those four battalions in Rafah.
France is threatening an embargo of weapons and ammunition to Israel if the IDF enters Rafah. Can you comment on that?
Well, I think in my last answer, I gave the Prime Minister and the War Cabinet and the entire Israeli population's view on leaving Hamas standing in Rafah. We will not allow it to happen. It is a key part of our war aims. Hamas remaining in Rafah is essentially us admitting to defeat, and that will not happen. As for the French question, I think it'll be probably best if you ask the French what their intentions are.
David Mentzer, spokesperson at the National Public Diplomacy Directorate. Taking a midway look at the headlines this evening, the U.S. abstained in a U.N. Security Council vote on a Gaza ceasefire demand, prompting Prime Minister Netanyahu to cancel a scheduled trip by senior aides to Washington to discuss alternatives to a broad military offensive in Rafah. A U.S. official says of Netanyahu's decision that the U.S. is perplexed by what it describes the overreaction to the vote on the Gaza ceasefire at the Security Council. The Shin Bet says it foiled Iranian plans to smuggle advanced weapons to terrorists in Judea and Samaria. IDF forces conclude operations in the Hamad section of Khan Yunis. Rockets were fired today at Ashdod from Gaza for the first time in 2 months. New National Right Party leader Gideon Saar announces he is pulling out of the government, saying that he was unable to have any impact and cannot take responsibility. His move comes against the backdrop of the refusal to his request to be included in the war cabinet and help navigate the war. Coalition tensions are high as the government is set to convene tomorrow to discuss the Prime Minister's draft of a proposal for a law on military exemptions for yeshiva students. The weather outlook, windy with seasonal temperatures, becoming much warmer over coming days. Families of hostages have erected a special sukkah in Dizengoff Square this evening and are underscoring the fact that while the nation celebrates Purim, the families of the 134 hostages still kept in Gaza are still in Simchat Torah when the Hamas October 7th attack occurred. The families are urging decision makers to fulfill the mitzvah of redeeming the captives. This afternoon in Jerusalem, some of the families of hostages marched alongside Jerusalem Mayor Moshe Leon in a United in Purim parade, the first Purim parade in the capital in over four decades. After the mayor came under criticism for being detached from the national mood amid the war by holding the event, its elements were toned down and it was dedicated to calls for the release of the hostages. Still, several dozen demonstrators who objected to having any parade still protested. Among the hostage family members at the parade was Mirav Lashem Gonen, whose daughter Romy is held captive. She said of U.S. and international efforts to bring the hostages home that more needs to be done. And also at the event, protesting was David Haid, who said that given the current situation, this is not a time for celebrations. First, Lashem Gonen.
The United States is doing a lot to be an ally to Israel and to bring back the hostages. Still, they are not here. It means that we didn't do everything. And I expect any leader in the world to continue pushing and bringing back our beloved ones. My daughter, she needs to be here. She was supposed to be here. I'm wearing a shirt she was supposed to wear, and I'm waiting for her.
I feel very sad, not only for the hostages themselves and their families, but also for the people of Israel, who celebrate without a real cause for celebration. I know it's a traditional habit to be happy on Purim, but this year I think it's tactless to do these carnivals.
A protester in Jerusalem. Police have signed off on an order closing for 30 days the Shlomo Arena in Tel Aviv after violence erupted between fans or rival fans after a match of the Hapoel Tel Aviv and Hapoel Haifa basketball teams. When Tel Aviv lost by a point, its fans attacked the other team's fans. One person required medical treatment. Four arrests have been made so far. Turning abroad briefly, France has joined the United States in saying intelligence indicates Islamic State was responsible for the attack on a concert hall outside Moscow that killed at least 137 people, while Russia continues to suggest that Ukraine was to blame. In the deadliest attack inside Russia for two decades, four men burst into Crocus City Hall on Friday night, spraying bullets during a concert. Alongside the dead, 182 people were wounded. Four men of Tajik origin have been remanded in custody on terrorism charges. Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack. Russian officials have claimed without evidence Ukrainian involvement. Kiev says the claim is absurd. Donald Trump's criminal trial on charges stemming from hush money paid to a porn star is set to begin on April 15th. A judge said today, paving the way for the Republican presidential candidate to either be convicted or cleared before the November 5th election. The date all but ensures that Trump will become the first ever former U.S. president to go on trial for criminal charges. Trump's lawyer said it was unfair for Trump, who held the office from 2017 to 2021, to stand trial while he runs for president. Trump has pleaded not guilty to 34 counts of falsifying business records to hide his former lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen's $130,000 payment to silence adult film actress Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election about a sexual encounter she says they had a decade earlier, an encounter that Trump denies. Turning to other news, Israel's urban centers are undergoing a revolution, creation of transportation hubs that integrate residential space, commercial space, and public transit to streamline travel and create economic activity. Leading this urban design effort is architect Amir Mann, founding partner of Amir Mann Amishinar Architects and Planners, who spoke to us about the process.
We did a strategy, major work with a company named Grimshaw from London and Arup also from London. We did the work for Netivea alone and for the Ministry of Transportation. And the purpose of the work was the fact that the public transportation, public traffic, that being built right now is built by different companies, different agencies of Israel, and it's not coordinated. So you have TAR that are doing the LRT, the red line, the green line, and all the other lines. You have the Metro, which is another group of NETA that they are not coordinating each other. You have the commuter train between the cities that are controlled by the train authority. You have the fast lane train, that is another story that is happening by another agency. And you have the buses by other groups. And the most important element is not represented. It's the passenger. The passenger is the user of all of this mode of transportation. And he is not represented. And then you have the private car. What happened in the last few years, the public transportation got the priority and the passenger by the Ministry of Transportation, which is something to appreciate, with the understanding that we will have to give up private cars. We cannot move anymore. See what's going on in all our roads, all the traffic jams all over us. But the understanding that the passenger with one ticket will have to have the opportunity and the priority to move easily between the different mode of transportation. And this is usually the solution around the world. Basically, it's called a hub station. In this situation, when you have a lot of element of public transportation, you need to build a different element. It's a hub. And the hub is make sure that not only the clarity and the short movement between the mode of transportation is adopted and happening, it also creates a place. It's a public building. It's in some countries, in Moscow, the metro station is a museum. So it's also the place you're making that you need to do for the passenger to appreciate this place. And the main reason it has to be a very good coordinated design is that we are talking about some of the stations get a huge amount of passengers in 1 hour. And in a day, sometimes they can get up to 200,000 people per day or something like that. So it's a major meeting place with the experience of the passenger. And when we talk about passenger, we talk about also the bicycles and coffinets, all the other smaller elements that need to be taken care of. Now, so that's one part of our work that we did. We did the most important five stations along Netivei Ayalon. We did the work on Savidor, on Ashalom, Haganah, Chulon, and Glilot. And now, suddenly, we are doing for actual construction, we're doing Be'er Sheva. So every city has one major hub. A city like Tel Aviv has a series of hubs all along Netivei Ayalon, and that's what we are dealing with.
In Tel Aviv, for example, you have a station like HaShalom, which is connected to a large shopping center, and connections can be made there as well to buses and so on and so forth. There are other train stations as you move out, particularly toward the periphery, where the stations themselves are away from the population centers, which create a challenge in and of themselves to even get people out there to use them, especially if they don't have private cars.
Yeah, well, basically the concept is that the main mode of transportation take you to the hub station. From the hub station, you move to the periphery or to Rishon LeZion or to neighborhoods with a secondary level of transportation, maybe LRT, maybe busing, maybe metro. But the hub is the meeting place of all of this element in one place. And right now, the way it's being designed, all of the elements, like even the metro and even the LRT, a lot of it is under construction, is not coordinated. It's not designed in a way of a hub. It designed each one by itself. And that's a major problem. And we did the work how to take whatever built and add the additional work that we're taking place and make it into a hub like it's being done all over the world.
So you're talking about creating physical connections because, as you mentioned earlier, there are different pieces and organizations that are responsible for each element of the transport.
They need to work together under the Ministry of Transportation. That's why the Ministry of Transportation ordered this type of work. And we understand that connection is not just a physical connection. Physical connection could be a corridor 2 meters wide, maybe 50 meters long. That's not a real connection. A connection is experience of space. This is a hub station, is a public building. Hub station around the world don't have only transportation. They have commercial activity. They have public activity, performance spaces, all kind of other activities. That's the idea, and the reason is because there is a huge amount of people moving through them, from them and to them. And the other part of our work is the fact that this amount of people create economic activity. When you have a place in a city that you have tens of thousands or maybe 100,000 people, during the day, gathering over there, waiting for their public transportation. You can pick up this amount of people, and you can create, and that's why the urban design around these stations usually is very intensive. And so part of our work is to see what kind of uses we can add on top of them or around them, like small cities around them. And it's include the working places, including public facilities, including even housing. It's to intense the area around it. And the reason is because economic-wise, these areas around that, adjacent to them and above them, are the will become the most expensive land in the city.
You mentioned a current project now is focusing in Be'er Sheva?
No, right now the activity of the hub station, and of course the priority of is the following. Right now, first of all, the five stations or six stations along Netivei Ayalon. Savidor, Ashalom, Agana, Hulon, and Glilot. Each one is more. And now the problem with the hub, this is another problem. It's a very complicated urban design architectural issue. The problem that the elements of transportation are in different levels. The fast lane train is 45 to 60 meters into the ground. The metro is 30 meters into the ground. The light rail train, the LRT, that is being built right now, is 12, 15 meters under the ground. The commuter train is on the ground. And then you have Netivei Ayalon, and then you have a lot of transportation issues. And the big issue is how you connect these different levels with some special, with a space. How you connect them vertically with the space and how you don't disperse them all around. And you have to have, right now the situation that passengers come with, let's say, with the metro 30 meters underground, they go up to the ground, then they walk maybe 100 meters, 200 meters to the train to find where is the train. This is not a solution. It has to be one space, one ticket. You buy one ticket and you can move between the different modes of transportation any place you want. And this is something that was not done. It was something that, to my opinion, was supposed to coordinate already 10 years ago. A lot of things already in the LRT built already. But it was not done, but it's not too late. So that's what we are doing. We develop guidelines. How to do it, including parameters, dimensions, everything, how conceptually it should be done. Our material is being given to all the other architects and planners and traffic engineers and to everybody, and they work accordingly. We do also some reviews of the work that's being done, and we ourselves are designing some of this work. We were surprised that Netivei Ayalon contact us about a year ago and ask us to do a hub in Be'er Sheva. So apparently Be'er Sheva is not the center of the Gush Dan. It's a hub also. And the same issues in Be'er Sheva where you have in the central station, you have a train, you have LRT, you have busing, bus station, central bus station. And you have busing and all the elements, and you have taxis and etc. All the elements that we create already the hub of Be'er Sheva. So Be'er Sheva is a city where it's located, maybe need one hub. I just finished one small hub. I did a small station in Kiryat Ariel, Petah Tikva. It was very difficult, and I had to coordinate. I did it for NETA, and I had to coordinate the train authority with NETA. In one station. It was my idea because originally there was a train station and there was an LRT. And I said, why the passengers should not enjoy one station, one space. I did it. It's built. It's working right now. But it was a very difficult process. It's very difficult to work with these agencies, that each one run on their schedule with their project. You need to take a breath and say, guys, before we build and spend billions of dollars, let's take a look how we should do it the best for the passengers.
It sounds like a lot of moving parts to get things moving.
That's what's fun about the architecture profession.
Architect Amir Mann. Before the weather and return headlines, here's Uri Weil. Al HaRakevet LeTel Aviv, on the train to Tel Aviv.
פרברים של תל אביב רואים חצרות אחוריות של תל אביב בתי כפרות ובשגו טעות וגם בתים נוסע אלייך עכשיו תל אביב לחפש חצר פנימית אחרי חומת בתי קומות גנים סגורים וחנויות מאודרות ואנשים מתים ברכבת כולם ישנים אני מסתכל בחצרות אחוריות של תל אביב שואל את עצמי כבן הפרברים של תל אביב נושא עיני השמיים רוצה לברוח מהעיר הנגדד ראשון השמיים תלו אותך בגובה מאתיים להותיר אותי חסר עונים ברכבת כולם מתעוררים אני אוהב שוחק בוחר לעיר בוחרת
The weather outlook, warmer with seasonal temperatures, strong winds, especially in the north and along the coast. Wednesday will be hot for the time of year, with Thursday bringing Shirav conditions over most of the country. Friday will be cooler, but still unseasonably warm. The temperatures forecast for tonight and tomorrow, Jerusalem 8 to 19, Tel Aviv 15 to 22, Haifa 13 to 19, Tzfat 7 to 15, Tiberias 11 to 24, Beersheba 9 to 24, and in Eilat from 11 degrees tonight going up to 28 degrees Celsius tomorrow. Taking another look at the news headlines this evening, the U.S. abstained in a U.N. Security Council vote on the Gaza ceasefire demand, prompting Prime Minister Netanyahu to cancel a senior aide's trip to Washington. A U.S. official says Washington was perplexed by what was described as the Israeli Prime Minister's overreaction to the abstention. The Shin Bet says it foiled Iranian plans to smuggle advanced weapons to terrorists in Judea and Samaria. IDF forces conclude an operation in the Hamas section of Khan Yunis. Rockets were fired today at Ashdod from Gaza for the first time in 2 months. National Right Party leader Gideon Saar announces he is resigning from the government, saying he could not have an impact on the direction of the war. This after his request to be included on the war cabinet was rejected. The weather outlook, windy with seasonal temperatures becoming much warmer over coming days. That's the news. Join us tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on Kan Reka, the foreign languages channel of the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation. You can watch our 2 p.m. news flash on the Kan English Facebook page, find us on Spotify, Twitter, or write to us at kanenglish@kan.org.il. Together with sound engineer Michael Olschwang, this is Nomi Seko wishing you good evening and shalom from Jerusalem.